Jason Capper here, asking you to help us save the C-53 Beat City Baby from the scrapper's torch. Folks, every dollar goes directly towards the restoration so that we can fly her again. Donate now at www.vintagewingsinc.com. That's vintagewingsinc.com. Our time is limited, and the need is now. So again, please go to www.vintagewingsinc.com. And help us save our C-53 Beat City Baby.
Live from the land of the free, because of the brave, this is Warbird Radio.
Howdy, howdy. This is Zane Adams, your host on the Texas Warbird Report here on warbirdradio.com. We're coming to you live from the great state of Texas, here in North Texas in the DFW area. Nice warm evening in the great state here, and we'll be talking air shows and such. And tonight we've got a couple of good guests, or maybe one or two. We'll see how it works out. We had a little technical difficulties, but it'll work out. We'll have some program for you for sure. Just want to give you guys a quick reminder, a couple of things going on in the state. Looks like air shows in this area are kind of on the wane. It starts warming up. It gets a little too warm to have the kiddos and the family out on the concrete for 12 hours a day during the air shows. But there's a couple of things coming up here, June 21st here in the Dallas area, in Addison, the north of Dallas. There's the Warbirds over Addison, the Kavanaugh Museum putting on a good show. It's just kind of a fly-in, they've invited some extra guests in. It looks like, last I heard, they may have 8 or more P-51 Mustangs, several visitors coming in from out of town to hang out on the ramp with the Brat there, their P-51, so that should be interesting. Never know what's going to show up at their fly days they have there at the Addison Airport. That's the Kavanaugh Flight Museum, so check them out. Also, that same weekend, local plug for our local Fort Worth Museum, the Fort Worth Aviation Museum, just kind of getting started. They're a static museum, a lot of current military stuff, recently were military stuff, but real interesting collection, a real interesting bunch of guys over there. And they're holding their hops and props, a good airplane and beer fest going on there at the Meacham Field at the southeast corner of Meacham Field there in Fort Worth. That's this weekend. That's hops and props out there with the Fort Worth Aviation Museum. They're raising funds to try to get a B-58 Hustler out of one of the museums that's divesting their collection. The museum's closing down, and they're trying to get that airplane back to Texas, back here in Fort Worth where it was built. So they're doing fundraising for that. The Fort Worth Aviation Museum's good work, so we need to support them on trying to get that B-58 Hustler back to Texas. So pretty exciting project they got going there. And Hops and Props will help them out with that plan. The only other air show here local, the Denton Air Show, comes up in June. It promises to be good and warm, but that's Denton, north of Fort Worth. They have a June air show. That's June 18th, so be sure to check that out. Local CAF guys, Fifi's on the road. Check them out, the B-24, B-29 squadron. So they left town, and they're out running. So, lots of exciting stuff going on here in Texas. Of course, like I said, summertime. Those guys tend to go north. The air shows move north, or it tends to be a little cooler. So, and of course, we're looking forward to being at that little air show in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, again this summer, hanging out there with Matt in the Warbird area. So, really looking forward to that, and that coming up in July. So, that's pretty exciting stuff. Tonight we've got a little technical difficulty getting our prime guest, but we got the next best thing. Here is Ralph Royce is our guest here tonight, and Russell, who is joining us on the line. Russell, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Hey, how are you? This is Russell Royce. For those that don't know, he's grown up in the shadow of Ralph. I can't imagine that. That's got to be interesting.
Oh, very much so.
And he's kind of taken over some of the, I've seen you at a few air shows. You're doing some of the, it looks like your dad may do Saturday and you may do Sunday, and the doing the air boss thing with your dad there. And that's got to be fun. That's got to be great. And it's great fun to watch you guys work together. And, so other than that, what else are you doing?
You're trying to stay out of trouble. Yeah, and this year's been real interesting because this year a lot of the shows that we do annually have fallen on the same weekend. So I've had an opportunity to branch out and do a couple of shows completely on my own, independent of Dad, whereas he would normally do those shows by himself.
Oh, great.
Yeah, so things are really expanding for us.
Cool, cool. Are you doing this? Is this the same organization, the Air Pros Air Show Consultant guys? Is that what your umbrella?
Yes, sir. Working under the Air Pros umbrella.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, cool. Good for you. Good for you. You seem to do a great job there, Russell. I've seen you, like I said, I've seen you at work. Saw you do last month a little bit there at the Carswell NAS Fort Worth, and saw you a couple years ago at Houston handling that madness that was the Vietnam demo they had with
that Vietnam sequence. That was a nightmare.
Yeah, and for those that weren't around or not privy to that, man, you had helicopters down low, you had guys on the ground, you had the blasters out there in the field with their explosions, and you had medium movers and fast movers and supersonic jets coming around. It was fantastic, I tell you. You guys put on a great show there.
Really neat things about that was a lot of people don't know the Wings Over Houston morning briefing. It lasts about 2 hours, and I usually end up doing the first half of the show because the first half of the show starts while the briefing's still going on. So the first half of the people will get released to Houston, will brief second half. Well, that year I briefed the Vietnam sequence, and that took about an hour and a half, and everybody's eyes kind of glazed over, but we made it work.
Well, it worked. The whole thing, Wings Over Houston's pretty great undertaking. It's one of the better air shows in the country, I think. And you guys handling that Vietnam deal was pretty fantastic. So, but when you were growing up, you grew up probably like me. I mean, I'm 50. You're a little younger than I am. But hanging out in the hangars around, at Ellington and Harlingen and such, I mean, how was it having the run of the ramp when as a kid in the CAF?
Oh, I got in a lot of trouble, I'll tell you that. as a young kid, it was a lot of fun because, you're the little guy and they'd let you clean the airplanes. And, of course, you got to clean the underside of the airplane because you're the little guy and you're the new guy. And that's what you do when you're the new guy. But then when you're 15, 16, and I'm 6'3", and I still have to clean the underside of the airplane because I'm still the youngest guy out there. It starts to get a little frustrating.
I can imagine.
But, no, it was a blast, and it was really interesting. It's one of those things now that I'm 30 that I've really learned to appreciate because my grandfather fought in World War II, and he's still alive, but we lose a lot of these guys every day, and we lose a lot of that heritage every day. And just the ability to be around those people who served during that era and the things that I have learned that for someone in my position, and you think this is common knowledge, everybody knows that, but these are things that aren't in the history books because you're talking to guys who were there while you're standing next to one of the type of aircraft that was there, and just the amount of information I was able to learn as a young person growing up in the CAF, I really have learned to appreciate, and now that I'm 30, because we're losing so much of that so fast.
Yeah, and that's why we're here. That's why we do this Warbird thing, all of us collectively, whether you're an owner or just a talk abouter like we are here. The airplane sitting in front of the guy sure brings the stories out, or tends to, and that's what it's all about, is to remember the history. So.
Absolutely.
What good juicy story should we ask your pa? I think he's on the line now. So give me one little tidbit here, and we'll let you go back to your dinner or whatever you were doing, and we'll have to have you on again for sure, Russell.
I think one of the really neat stories that I think my dad tells is when he was getting checked out for the first time in a B-17, and I think it was by Ronnie Gardner. You'll have to fact check that. That's always a really interesting story that I think is very interesting. You should, I don't know if you're aware, do you know that he had a forced landing in an SPD?
Yeah, I've heard about that.
You should ask him about that, because that, you know, he wrote a really, really, I thought a really well done article on that. But the difference between an actual event and training for the event has always been my biggest takeaway from that story. But that's a fascinating topic to listen to my dad talk to as well.
Cool. We'll hit him up for those, Russell. I appreciate you coming on, filling in a little bit here. And we'll call you back someday, have you on here.
Yes, sir. Anytime.
Thanks, Russell. Talk to you soon, Russell. Bud.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You have a great day.
Bye-bye. All right, you too. So we got our...
So now we got the dirt. Let's see if the boss answers now. He actually, we're calling his cell phone here. Did away with the can and the string.
Okay.
He's not going to answer.
Come on.
Yes, he is.
Oh, there he is. There you go, Zane. He's all yours.
Well, beware. We were just talking to Russell, and he gave us a couple of things we needed to talk about with you, so beware.
Okay.
Well, Ralph, appreciate you coming on with me tonight. And for those that don't know Ralph, I mean, you've been a long time, executive director were of the CAF, Lone Star Flight Museum director.
Correct.
Texas Aviation Hall of Fame, ICAS Safety Committee. I mean, blah, blah, blah. It goes on and on and on. Flown a lot of airplanes. So,
you're correct.
Well, reading your bio online, it helps a little bit there. But yeah, when did you first get wrapped up with the CAF?
In 1977, a friend of mine said, we got to join this Warbird organization. He and I flew a little bit together, Bob Barnhart. And so we went down to Harlingen and joined the CAF. I got my dad to join the same year, and immediately jumped right into the fray down there in Harlingen. And I started doing a little backup mini bossing and flying in the B-17. And one thing led to another, and one year... I was sitting under the wing of the B-17 answering the questions of the people that came by. And one of the board members came up and said, do you think you could run this air show if you had to? And of course, being not seeing the trap that he was laying for me, I said, why, heck yeah. And he said, get in the cart. You're running it. I went, oh my God, I didn't even go to briefing today.
But now? Yeah.
That's exactly right. Now, you mean today? I was only kidding you, you know.
Yeah.
But I found out it was more fun than sitting under the wing of an airplane for 4 hours and then flying for 30 minutes and then wiping down the airplane and sitting under the wing of the airplane again. So I started doing it a little more and a little more and a little more, and it just built up.
You seem to be the go-to air boss, or at least in our part of the country. Well, shoot, you were at Oshkosh last year, or you've been at, it seems like just about every air show I've showed up for in the last few years, you've been sitting up there with your yellow shirt on top of the box, telling everybody what to do. It's a good thing. Things tend to run well as long as there's not a C-17 in the box, but, you know.
Yeah, well, but I've been fortunate. I've got probably somewhere around 1,100 show days under my belt, and 350, I don't know. I don't even count anymore.
Yeah.
But over 350 air shows. I've just been very fortunate. And you had Russell on earlier. He started on my hip when he was about 14 as a gopher. And now he's running his own shows. So
yeah, that's what he said. Yeah.
Time marches on. You know?
There it does indeed. It does indeed. So you're talking about the B-17, which you're talking about Sentimental Journey or Texas Raiders?
I flew on Texas Raiders for several years, and then I moved to Lone Star, and I started flying Thunderbird.
Okay.
And my first boss at Lone Star, Jim Foss, got me checked out in Thunderbird, and I've got quite a few hours on it for several years, thanks to the museum. And it's a great airplane. That B-17 is just a, you know, people are always asking you, which airplane was your favorite? Well, my favorite's the one I'm flying right now. Thank you very much. But the B-17 is a great old, if people ask me what it's like to fly, I tell them it's a 50,000 pound Piper Cub with a 5,000 horsepower engine.
That's what Doc Huskers used to say. So.
Yeah, well, because it flies just like a Cub. It's got a big fat wing. If it's a hot day and you're on a black asphalt runway and your gas is down to the bottom third of the tank, you'll float right down the runway. And it's very stable. It's got a nice stall recovery. It's really just a sweet airplane to fly. And once you get over once you get your speed right on landing, so you don't have to stick it. A lot of people stick it. It makes the landing ugly. But if you get your speed back down to where it should be, it'll just settle in the nicest three-point landing you can make.
Well. So tell us about when you first climbed into the B-17. You're getting your type rating, your checkout in that airplane.
Yeah, well, I had my multi-engine, and Jim started making me fly co-pilot, which I didn't object to at all.
No.
Because I got to learn the airplane inside and out. And, of course, our shops right there at Lone Star, before Ike wiped it out, were right underneath the windows of the offices. So I learned by watching, and I learned by getting up and wandering around and helping out occasionally down in the floor. And one day he said, "You're ready?" And I said, "For what?" And he said, "Ronnie Gardner's going to be down here next week. He'll give you your check ride." And I went, "Oh, my goodness." Because Ronnie Gardner in those days was a legend in the Confederate Air Force.
Sure. He was the Mr. One-Wheel Touchdown Darren Tora guy, right?
No, that was Vance Kyle.
Oh, okay.
That was Van Skiles. Ronnie Gardner was out of Dallas. He flew everything for everybody, and he had checklists. He had the neatest little fanny pack, and you'd open it up, and there were about 75 or 80 3x5 cards on there. And it didn't matter what airplane he was in, he could pull out a card with the appropriate numbers, the appropriate weights, appropriate power settings. He had it all on those 3x5 cards. Anyway, I got my check ride, and then I started flying it quite a bit, and I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Yep. And then I got to fly a couple other airplanes Lone Star had, and that was nice. A couple other people asked me to fly some airplanes, and I flew B-25s and F-6Fs and a couple other airplanes.
Yeah. Well, so tell us about that Hellcat. That's a different animal when you're the only guy in the airplane, and checkouts are a little different in that situation, and that's quite a hot rod. So,
it's funny. You go through the check in the T6, and then you get the backseat check ride in the T6, and then you get briefed by the guy who's going to check you out, and you go fly the airplane. And of course, you're a little bit apprehensive. But, you know, they had 19-year-olds flying them off the carriers during the war, so it couldn't be all that bad. And I found out that the Hellcat is a very nice airplane. It is solid as a rock. It has a little bit of torque management issues on takeoff. You got to get a strong right foot if you don't get enough trim in. But it'll climb like mad. It rolls very nicely. It's got very nicely balanced controls. And one of the nicest things about the Hellcat is that when you get in the pattern, when you get about halfway through the downwind, you reach up, you flip a switch, and that's all you have to do for flaps, because the flaps are spring-loaded. And as you slow down, they'll come down for just as much slat as flap as you need, and it rounds out and sits very nicely and tracks straight as an arrow.
Well, that's interesting. I never knew they had the spring-loaded flaps like that. So there's an auto flap in 1944. Quite an achievement, yeah.
Yeah. And the so when you put all that together, it was a bit of a disappointment. I was expecting to just fight myself into a raging lather to get this airplane under control. It was a real pussycat. It was a nice airplane to fly. I enjoyed that quite a bit.
So the other side of the coin, what's the airplane that you know, bit at your tail the whole time?
My Luscombe. I've got a Luscombe 8A, and that
I've heard about those. Like,
there's that airplane. We've got ours painted. They had two in the Army Air Corps during World War II. They were in the canal zone. They used them to fly back and forth across the isthmus there, and we've got ours painted in the 1942-3 colors. And it's named Junior, just like that one was, that they had in the canal zone. But anyway, it's that airplane, you got to fly it the whole time. There's no cruising in Alaska. You got to be on the ball all the time.
Yeah.
And it's more difficult than a T-6.
Yeah. I've heard stories about them. They look nice and pleasant sitting on the ramp, but
well, you'll have to come fly with me one time.
Yeah, that sounds like fun.
Yeah,
I mean, sure, the most vicious thing I've ever flown was a Piper Arrow. I mean, come on. So
well, they over rotate, but okay.
There you go.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
So the Warbird community has been very good to me, and I really appreciate everything everybody's done. I've gotten to ride in or fly just about everything, and learned a lot of history, and kept part of my family's lineage history alive, and so that's been good to me.
Yeah, well, and let's talk about, if you don't mind, a little bit about that. Your family, your grandfather. And some sort of gang of raiders. So tell us a little bit about who he was.
Granddad was in the South Pacific when the war started. And when everybody bailed out of the Philippines, he ended up in Australia. And they wanted to make a raid on the Japanese. So Granddad got three B-17s, and I forget how many B-25s and A-20s. Anyway, they flew up to the Dole Pineapple Plantation Airport, and they loaded them up, and they went and raided Manila Harbor. And they bombed the Japanese at Manila Harbor, and they got away, came back, couple of days later did it again, and I think there was a third raid, and by then the Japanese figured out where they were coming from, so they loaded up everybody and headed for home. And that happened 7 days before the Doolittle raid. Of course, Doolittle bombed Japan,
right,
and a direct hit to the homeland, but they sunk a couple of boats in Manila Harbor, and they tore up the docks.
But early in 42, so it's still quite a feat. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Well, somewhere around here, I got the front page of the New York Times with Granddad's picture on it. But he was a very interesting character. He was a bit of a fireplug, and played hockey and baseball for West Point, and had a big old nose, because his nose had gotten broken twice during hockey matches. I think they were a little rougher in those days. Anyway, he graduated. He went and learned to fly at North Island, And then his first assignment was with the 1st Aero Squadron with Blackjack Pershing chasing Pancho Villa out of Columbus, New Mexico.
Yeah.
And they never found him. They flew all over that northern Mexico territory, Mexico territory, and they never found him.
Well, yeah, after, they wrecked. I guess Pancho Villa, invaded the U.S. and raided Columbus. And so, they sent those guys down there. So your dad was there in that, huh? That's interesting.
My granddad was.
Your granddad, I'm sorry. Very cool.
And they never found him, but they wrecked every airplane they had at least twice.
Are they flying Jennies, I guess?
They were flying Curtiss C-2s and JN-3s, I believe.
Yeah.
And my grandfather claims credit for 5 of them, so he's an ace. Then he went on to, he led the 1st Aero Squadron in World War I in France. He took the 1st Aero Squadron across to France, and they flew Samson airplanes, which was a French built with 165 radial engine in it. French built biplane with an observer in the back. And that's all they had to fly because the Army Air Corps didn't have any airplanes for them. Just like the 1st pursuit group, they flew Samsons and borrowed some other French Newports.
Sure.
He ended up the war as a lieutenant colonel. Can you imagine that? In these days, it was 1918. He was a lieutenant colonel, having graduated West Point in 1914. Of course, as soon as the war ended, they made him a captain. Left him a captain forever. Anyway, he was an early figure in the Arnold Andrews Spatz Doolittle era.
Yeah.
And commanded Selfridge Field a couple of times when Selfridge Field was a big deal. Led the cold weather flights in 1930 and won the McKay Trophy for that. Anyway, so he did well.
Ended up as a general. He got a star for his all over, right?
Two stars.
Two stars. Yeah.
Two stars. Yeah. He was the senior air officer afloat during the Normandy invasion. It was Royce Kirk for the Navy, an admiral, and Omar Bradley for the Army were all on the, I think it was the cruiser Augusta, if I remember correctly.
Wow.
Anyway, so he had a nice career. My dad was a missile man. He was in the B-24s in North Africa as an engineering officer.
Okay.
And then he came home and worked on the B-29s with General Ant in the 2nd Air Force, trying to figure out why all the B-29s were catching on fire, and then finally figured out it was the exhaust valves in some of the cylinders. And he went on to be a very early missileer and had the Navajo program down at the Cape and spent his entire career in the missile business for the Air Force.
Sounds like they were there at the beginning of everything.
Well, they were up until I came along, and I was a heathen. I joined the Army.
Ah, there you go.
Yeah.
What did you do for Uncle Sam?
I was an artillery guy. I went to OCS and was an artillery guy and stayed in for about 4 years and then got out and went back and finished school. But I learned to fly on Air Force bases. I originally soloed in an Aero Club T-34 and at Holloman years and years ago in the Dark Ages.
Yeah, because that was a missile base, right? Yeah.
Holloman was not. It was a research base.
Yeah.
Well, Dad was an R&D kind of missileer, silo type missile air.
Okay, there you go. So he was out playing on white sands, and
yeah, he was. He was. So was I in the T-34.
Yeah,
I'll have to tell you that one offline sometime. And Tony Davis. Oh, my goodness. Long time ago. But, and I got, I did 16 years as president of Lone Star. Did 8.5 years as executive director of the CAF, and I was not, I was the single no vote against the move to Midland. And when you do that as president, you have two choices. You can be a cheerleader or you can get out of Dodge. So I tried cheerleading for about 3 months and I just didn't like that. So
yeah.
I got out of Dodge.
Well, I was a no vote as well, although my vote didn't count, but I thought it was a silly idea. But hey, we got a caller calling in. You want to take a blind call, see what he has to say?
Only if they'll be kind.
All right. Hello, caller.
Oh,
who do we have here?
Hello. Oh, I'll be kind. My name's Spencer Studerman. I'm somewhat of a flying aficionado. Hey, I was wondering from the standpoint of a really experienced air boss, how do they handle it when people don't silence their cell phones during briefings?
Spencer, I will get you for this, young man. What he's telling me is that last weekend, because some cohorts of his set me up, when somebody's in a briefing and the cell phone goes off, I put him in the dunce chair. Well, Spencer called me right in the middle of the briefing. You got me, Spencer, but I will get you back.
I know you will. You know who put me up to it? You know who started this world famous gag, don't you?
It was Huggy.
Oh, of course. Let me tell you how dedicated Huggy is, and this is how close the Air Show family is. When Huggy was in the Air Force and deployed in Afghanistan, he woke up in the middle of the night to call into an Air Show briefing at Santa Rosa. And he actually got the air boss there. He got the legendary Willie Turner during his own briefing at Santa Rosa from Afghanistan. That is a man dedicated to his mission.
I was working with Huggy, and when that phone rang, the first thing I looked at was Huggy, and he held his hands up in the air. But I knew he had something to do with it, Spencer.
I won't say he texted me while I was out shopping that day, but he said in 15 minutes you need to make a phone call.
Well, there you go.
Well, Spencer, you know, Spencer Suderman is a man of some historic note. He just set
he likes flat spins, right?
Inverted flat spins. So how many, Spencer? 99?
It was 98. On March 20th, over Yuma, Arizona, over the Yuma Proving Grounds, I climbed my little Pit Fest 1 up to 24,500 feet and did 98 inverted flat spins, recovering at 2,000 feet.
Woo-hoo. So you know what that tells you about Spencer Suderman?
Yeah.
He's nuts.
A lot.
Even
a
more
lot.
Than the phone call, right? Yeah.
Hey, but you
good
know,
to talk to you, Spencer.
Yeah, and you know, Spencer flies the PT-26 too, so we'll have to have him back on to talk about flying that great airplane out west.
Oh yeah,
there you go.
Yeah,
good call, Spencer.
That's a great. Actually, this is the PT-19 version, the open cockpit one. I will tell you, it is. You know what's amazing about that airplane? My grandfather actually did his primary flight training in the Army in 1943 in that same type airplane in Texas. So to me, it has a very special, not just historical significance, but a very special place for me. And it's a great airplane to fly. A lot of fun, too.
Oh, I imagine.
Well, I'm going to clear the line because about 10 other people are calling in right now, Spencer.
There you go. It's 4-7.
All right. I got one last thing to say. Bernoulli before Marconi.
There you go.
You're getting it.
Oh, that's aviation.
Point. And that is that some of those, I've been doing the same briefing for so long. Some of the pilots know it better than I do. I still have to look at the notes.
Hey, Ralph, well, it's Matt here. I want to jump in because we're having – this is actually a question. I've sent it to Zane here. We have a couple of these that have been coming in about truth or fiction of early stories in Warbirds. I will not say the name of the organization that these are presumably
okay.
from, but it's one
okay.
that you may or may not have an intimate understanding of. In the early
okay.
days, truth or fiction? This one is written in here from maybe I shouldn't even say his name is Randy, And it's not the guy that flies the MiG, but he writes and he says, any truths to A-26s over Cuba?
Well, now,
well,
my problem is I don't know whether it's truth or fiction, but I have heard many tales that a certain group of West Texas and South Texas individuals were hired to fly A-26s in support of the Bay of Pigs invasion. And I've also heard tales about them training in Bartow, Florida, and I don't know whether that's true or not, but I've had a lot of people tell me about it, and they were properly lubricated so that the tails got bigger. So I have to figure where there's smoke, there's fire in that case.
Okay. Well, if you have a truth or fiction question tonight for Ralph Royce, the number again is 478-787-4768. There's about three more here, Zane, but I'll wait until you need something.
So. There you go. Well, I want to ask Ralph. So you're flying a CAA airplane. You're cruising along in the sky, and a certain Douglas airplane and the motor quit. Tell us about that.
Oh, no, that was a Lone Star airplane.
Oh, okay.
So we'd been out on a photo shoot with a gentleman who did Honor Squadron, and he wanted to do a 10 episode Honor Squadron, and he was building a preview for the TV networks, and they had the first handheld Sony high definition shoulder camera, which was about 2.5 or probably 3 feet long. It was a huge thing. And they
probably
had it
weighed
in the
40 pounds. Right?
Yeah. Oh God, I don't know how much it weighed. They had one in the B-25 and another one in the back seat of the SBD. And this was our third flight of the day. And we were at about 1,500 feet. Bill Hill and his TBM was on one side of the B-25, and I was on the other side of the B-25. We were actually in a pretty good VIC, and the engine unwound. And I'm telling you, when the engine quits and you're only at 1,000 feet, things happen in a hurry. So the SBD has four fuel tanks, and I am... switch tanks, boost pump on, mixture rich on every one of those tanks half a dozen times in about 6 seconds. And nothing happened except gas started spraying on us. So long story short, we weren't close enough to the airport, but we were close enough to a large cow pasture and we'd had rain for like 3 days before. So it was muddy as could be. So we just bellied it in. And that old SBD, that was a sturdy airplane because we did very little damage to it until the trip home, because on the trip home, the trucking company had strapped down the wings to the flatbed, and one of the straps came loose and got cinched underneath the wheel and crushed about 5 feet of the leading edge of the SBD wing.
Yeah.
And that was the year after we'd won... We had restored that airplane, and we had won reserve grand champion at Oshkosh. I was certainly disappointed in that, and a friend of mine was on the judging committee, and he said, "You know why you won reserve grand champion instead of grand champion?" I said, "Well, yeah, why?" And he showed me way up inside the linkage for the tail wheel. There was a nut. It was a castellated nut, and it didn't have a cotter key in it.
Uh-oh.
And he says, that's what cost you the... Because they came back and looked three times.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's what they look for.
Yeah, all the little stuff.
Yep.
Well, so, you didn't tear... You didn't. You walked away from the landing, which they say is a good
thing. Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah.
And
great ones when you can reuse the airplane, so it was just an okay one.
Yeah, there you go. You still bent the prop and you know.
That's a prop. Yeah. And the SPD has a little crutch that holds the swing gate that holds the bomb to get the bomb below the arc of the propeller.
Right.
And that acted as a keel. And we went about probably 60 yards from the time we first stopped to the touchdown to the end. And the SPD has a huge compass, one of those old Navy compasses that hangs down. And when you forget to lock your seatbelt, your real inertial harnesses, you reach up and you smack that thing with your head.
So that's what's wrong with you.
That's everything.
Oh yeah.
My life's never been the same. Yeah, it was, and the guy in the back seat didn't get, I mean, he was a Vietnam vet, and he said, I was trying to talk to him, but he didn't have his helmet on because he was already getting secured and securing that camera. And he said, when that engine quit and I looked where the airport was and where we were, I already knew what was going to happen.
There you go. Yep. So what did that teach you about your training?
Well, it taught me a lot of things. There was an article that came out in a magazine, but it taught me that there's never enough time. Doesn't matter if you're 120,000 feet or 1,000 feet, there's never enough time. Fly the airplane all the way to the ground. Don't fall the airplane. And I was really grateful to my dad for making me have to learn gliders before I learned to fly. Because when I was a kid, gliders weren't all that cool.
Yeah.
And and all I had was a lousy glider that day.
Bad glider. Yeah, that's right. So
fly the airplane. Don't fly.
You ready for another truth or fiction?
Okay.
All right, gentlemen. I'm going into the truth or fiction email bag here.
Yeah.
Here's one from Paula. Paula wants to know, is there any truth or is it fiction that certain aircraft in a certain museum early on may or may not have flown contraband over the border? And she has in parentheses here, firearms and other such items. Any truth to night missions, or is it pure fiction?
Why are you doing this to me?
Well,
the fans want to know.
Everyone wants to know. You know, so I want to hear how you're gonna navigate
weasel out of this one. Yeah. Well, it's the same answer as last time. Properly lubricated at the Officers Club in Arlington. I heard many tales about that, but I have a confirming factor for one C-47 ride that didn't go so well. The one of the guys got picked up and spent a year in jail down there.
Uh-huh.
And two of the guys had to hike their way out across the desert. Thank goodness it was not in a CAF airplane, but the crew may or may not have been CAF members.
Now, look, I didn't say that. You said that. This is, I don't know what museum we're talking about, but there's just a lot of,
yeah, you do.
There's a lot of mystique that's built into this that I think lends to its credibility today. I mean, there were ways of saving this stuff.
Yeah.
The old days of Harlingen, we'll never recreate them. I mean, we would have the Canadians, we had a 4-day air show in the first place. Started on Thursday, and by Sunday, we had it down pretty pat. And there were traditions that build up about when certain airplanes would fly in, and the Canadians would all fly down to Breckenridge and meet up with Duke Corsair and have a big party at his place, and then they'd all arrive on Thursday afternoon at 4:00. I mean, it was like clockwork, and I've seen Silver Lady come in with maybe 4 Mustangs on one wing and 5 Mustangs on the other wing and a Sea Fury in the slot. I mean, it was amazing. We would have 150, maybe even one year, I think we had 168 Warbirds on the ramp in Harlingen doing the doing the air show. It was a big deal.
I think my first show down there was probably 76 or 8, somewhere in there, when I finally made it down there. And I was amazed. Of course, you know, here I am, a 12-year-old that just read about and looked at pictures of these things, and here they all are. And you're right, it was something else. And I know in the 80s, flew down there with Doc Hospers. Of course, he was on a little bit of the outs with the CAF at the time for some reason or another, and he just flew his airplane down there and parked it on the end of the ramp by the general aviation. But we still got to go to the O Club, and that was interesting as a 18-year-old in the officers' club at Harlingen.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
That was quite interesting.
Boy can get an education real fast in the officers' club.
Ralph, it's Matt again. Yeah. I know I had asked you this before, but I think you touched on this just now. I remember one night I asked you, I said, was it as big as I remember it as a kid, you know, back there? I think my first show was 83. And I think you just said that it was. But I want to know truth or fiction about that Officers Club experience. Because you had, at the time, I mean, Archie Donahue was a Torah pilot. I mean, there were, Pappy Boyington was down there. I mean, the greats of World War II were there just every day. What was that experience like?
Oh, it was, you know, squadron rules is what it was. It was like being in a squadron. It would have been a huge squadron, but it was like being in a squadron. Everybody knew everybody. If you didn't know them, you got to know them that evening. Everybody had a good time. It was a very interesting interaction of people. And when you had that many people, and crewmen who were type A personalities, you would think that it would get out of control. But in all my time down there, and I started going in 77, in all my time down there, I never saw an altercation. There were tricks played on people, some great paybacks, but I never saw any altercation. People were there to enjoy themselves, and we did at a very high level. And it wasn't that big a building. It was actually the officers' club from the old Harlingen Air Force Base, and it had a nice dance floor on it, and it had a pub, and it had a, and we added what you would call a Florida room type addition to it. But it was not that big a building, and it would be packed full of people. And yep, it would be packed full for the entire time.
Yeah. I remember just sitting in the corner at some table, just watching and drinking my Dr. Pepper.
Yeah. Well, those days are past now, I'm sorry to say.
Yeah. So, you know anything about, did you ever hang around with Junior Bergeron?
I never did have much to do with Junior. I know the name, I know some of the stories, but I never had any dealings with him at all.
Yeah. I just didn't know since he was running hot and heavy about those times. I didn't know if you were any dealings with him or not. So, interesting stories come out of there as well, but Yeah, and I'm a little sad that the CAF's lost some of their tongue in cheek in this modern have no fun world sometimes. But
you gotta remember, we're talking almost 50 years ago, and listen to me, I'm an old man for crying out loud. That was 50 years ago. Things change.
Yep, they do. They do. Yeah. So just reflecting. Since we're talking about old times, and what's something we can learn today regarding the operation of Warbirds? Learn from what they did back then. What are we doing different that's better or worse than back then?
I think our care and feeding of the engines is a lot better these days. You know, the synthetics have helped the inlines tremendously because you don't get that nasty 15 seconds for the galleries to fill up in the inlines.
Yeah.
But the synthetic, because the synthetics go through them so fast. And of course, the understanding of how the engines work and how you should treat them, there's a lot of experience with them now that is getting passed down. I also think people have become a lot more cognizant of systems, understanding systems. The whole world is a more systems oriented place nowadays.
Sure.
I mean, my goodness, there are airplanes that I don't even know how to fly because they don't have steam gauges in them. but the system that took over a TV screen with all the buttons on it, it's a system. It's a better system. So they have to be more cognizant of that.
Yeah.
And, other than that, I think people respect the airplanes a little more than they did. There's less, knock on wood, there's less hot rodding of some of the warbirds. You don't see as many guys trying to try the world's record for the lowest pass anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good thing.
Yeah, that is a good thing. It is a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I have a customer of mine. His name's Fred Disney, and his brother was the only Disney in the CAF. But
Dick Disney,
Dick, there you go, Dick Disney. Yeah, his
yes,
Dick. He died in a PBY crash, I guess, after maintenance hop. And Fred's one of my oldest customers, and he's an old World War II vet himself, a codger from the word go. But he tells stories of the CAF some, and talks about his brother and all those guys. So,
well, Dick Disney and C.A. Skiles, Van's brother, were taking a PBY on a test top, just as you said.
Yeah.
And right after takeoff, after they lost the runway and were coming up on this big arroyo that they have down there, they lost power. And Van was in the back of the airplane. And when they got through, they got stopped right next to one of the Western windows that was working in the airplane.
Yeah.
I he doesn't know, but he suspects that nobody was flying the airplane. Dick thought CA was flying it, and CA thought Dick was flying it.
Yeah, there you go.
There's a lot of talent in that airplane.
Yeah. Well, that's stuff we learn from. And I know you're involved with ICAS and their safety programs being the air boss and running the brief. And I know that you say that the guys know the brief better than you do sometimes, but I tell you, they all one thing I hear is it seems they take it to heart when you tell them not to do something stupid.
Yeah. So don't do nothing dumb.
There you go.
I was safety committee member for like 10 or 12 years. And I was chairman of it for 7 or 8 years.
Yeah.
But my opinion is that an air show is made in the briefing. If you do a thorough, good, complete briefing, you'll have a thorough, good, complete air show.
If you do
a lousy briefing, you're going to have a lousy air show. I'm firmly convinced that a briefing is one of the most important factors to have, if not the most important factor to having a good air show.
There you go. There you go. Well, Ralph, we're about out of time here, and I appreciate you coming on this with me this evening and putting up with our callers and our mystery questions and everything else. And, I hope to see you at an air show coming soon, and maybe we can go have dinner Ranshackle Steakhouse again sometime. So,
you bet.
I appreciate you coming on, Ralph. And
thank you.
Keep them honest.
We'll talk
there.
To you later. Don't do nothing dumb.
Thanks, Ralph.
Bye.
That's Ralph Royce here on the Texas Warbird Report. Great guest, great guy, and a lot of history there. Man, we covered everything from Pancho Villa in World War I to don't do nothing dumb at the air show. So I appreciate him being on tonight. Appreciate Matt helping me out a little bit with the show.
And, I'm just riding shotgun with my good buddy Zane.
There you go.
Fun, man. That was fun, wasn't it?
It was fun. It was fun. So from all of us here in Texas and around the country, you know, keep them flying. And we appreciate you being here. Thank you.
The Texas Warbird Report is produced in part by us here at warbirdradio.com. We're glad you tuned in. Tune in next month for an all-new episode of the Texas Warbird Report. Like them on Facebook, and we'll see you back here next month.